The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello. They were collaborators, literary gadflies, and champions of the common people. They were the leading lights of the Harlem Renaissance. Their names were Zora Neale Hurston, the author of Their Eyes Were Watching God, and Langston Hughes, the author of The Negro Speaks of Rivers and Let America Be America Again. After meeting at a great gathering of black and white literati, they traveled together through the rural South collecting folklore, collaborated on a play, wrote scores of loving letters to one another, and then had a bitter and passionate falling out. That's the story told in a new book by Yuval Taylor. He's here today to talk about Zora and Langston, a story of friendship and betrayal on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Hello, everyone. I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the podcast. It's good to be back, people. I know I've said in the past that October is my favorite month, but this September has been good, too. It's been October-y. Maybe we're going to have a good fall here in Crazy Town, USA. So, today, we have a fascinating story. But first, let's get to an email. Subject, the show. Hey, Jack. It's me again, the 19-year-old Dostoevsky fan from the smallest town in the smallest state of the USA. I was thinking a show covering French poets would be great. Arthur Rimbaud, Charles Baudelaire, Paul Verlaine, etc. I was struck by fate hearing your Marcel Proust episode because I had started reading Swan's Way a day before you uploaded it. I've been putting Proust off because I'm well aware he can be challenging, and his novel is quite a long one, but oh, am I happy I read it. The beauty of that novel is timeless. The email continues, I'm so very glad you're making episodes, and your writing about Proust, which you read at the end of the episode, really spoke to me. Going through life's mundane tasks can be tiring, but literature takes you into new worlds. You grow to love or hate the characters and be fully immersed in the setting the author creates, if they're a good one. Being 19, I've realized that not a lot of people my age are into literature or writing, and it's lonely not being able to share my enthusiasm with anyone. But I find myself having full-on conversations with you, and you and your show have made me a little less lonely. Keep up the great work. Nate. Oh, Nate. There you go, 19. I'm almost twice your age. Asterisk. Figures may not be exact due to rounding. I'm sorry to hear that not a lot of people your age are into literature or writing, but guess what? Not a lot of people of any age are into it, actually. We're the minority on this one. But that doesn't mean we're going extinct. I'm not going to blame 19-year-olds for not being into literature, just as I won't blame 10-year-olds or 70-year-olds or 62-year-olds or 37-year-olds and so on. I hope that list is enough for everyone to feel included. I'm not trying to hide the ball here. I don't have some secret animus against 41-year-olds, for example. I'm not blaming anyone. Imagine if you had to list every age once you get started. Blame those goddamn 46-year-olds. What the hell is up with them? They're the ones to blame. Just kidding. What I'm trying to say, Nate, is that you might feel alone in your circle with very few around you, but that's how I feel much of the time, and it's how many, many people who listen to the show feel. We're all on a lonely island, each of us, but there are thousands of us. We can see that from the numbers of listeners, and I'm sure that that's just scratching the surface. The good news is that we can all connect with one another across distance, across time, and literature does that too. Robert Louis Stevenson, our episode from a couple of weeks ago, that's a pretty brilliant mind to spend some time with. Very generous and very fun. And the Brontes last week. Who knew I could spend time with three women from Yorkshire who experienced great highs and lows in their lives and to see what they thought about the world and how romanticism and the example of Byron made their way into their hearts and minds in fiction. I can jump right in and sort of mind meld with authors like that as if we're old and dear friends, and I'm privy to not just their secret thoughts, but the way they think. Imagine if you loved, say, being in a marching band, and you found yourself living in a town that has no marching band. What could you do? Play the songs, maybe? Watch videos? Prance around your house with your instrument? But could you really have the joy of being in a marching band? Probably not. You'd be lonely. But literature is different. There's this little podcast. I'm glad to be a part of it, doing my share. But there's also the whole vast ocean of literature to dive into. The antidote to loneliness is to enjoy the time you spend with some great people, some rascals and villains among them, to be sure. And some are so boring you'll wish you'd never invited them over. But the bulk of them are there to keep you company, to keep you entertained, to keep you on your feet, on your toes, dancing like a boxer, throwing punches, taking a few, ducking, bobbing, weaving, working, actively putting your mind on full alert, seeing what comes of that, and then, when it's all over, exiting the ring and thinking about the thrill of what just happened. So there we go. Enjoy the match, and thank you for the email. That, dear listeners, was the appetizer. A quick break, and then let's get to our main course. Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. Hey, grown-ups. The Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. So today on the show, we have a fascinating subject, two extreme leading lights, two icons of the 20th century, two great writers with wide-ranging and eclectic interests and incredible personalities. And we have them falling in love with one another, in a friendship sense at least, and then falling out. It's a web of strong personalities, a tangled web that was woven, not just with these two, but the others around them as well. I'm fascinated by creative partnerships. My two great heroes, probably my first inspirations and probably my best and last, are John Lennon and Paul McCartney. I never get tired of hearing stories and thinking about how those two did what they did. Paul McCartney was like a songbird, a tuning fork that the gods play. Melodies come pouring out of him. Yesterday, Hey Jude, For No One, Here, There, and Everywhere. Are you kidding? Penny Lane, Eleanor Rigby, Let It Be. Imagine what it was like to be around that guy, to be in a band and you record a song all day and it's one of the most beautiful melodies you've ever heard. And then the next day you come back in and he has a brand new song and it's just as beautiful. Imagine watching that guy sit down at a piano and noodle around a little and suddenly start humming this gorgeous phrase and it turns into a song. Gorgeous, achingly gorgeous. Sometimes light, sometimes poignant. Always that kind of ear candy that gives you a compulsive shiver down your spine. Incredible. And then there's John, smart, raw, ragged, tapping into sources of pain, delivering the truth, summarizing life, asserting himself in his own songs, putting everything on the line, and dragging you along with him. Sometimes beautiful, sometimes incisive, always direct, upfront, demanding, generous, exposed, soulful, true. We have a lot of examples of creative partnerships or relationships. There's the Mozart and Salieri example from the play, I mean, not real life. A genius who has music shooting out of him as if he's some ethereal creature. And the man who's good enough to know just how good the other one is, how blessed he is, what a gift he has, and to see that he himself doesn't have that gift. How do these two get along, help one another, inspire one another, antagonize one another? Fascinates me. Then there's the Lennon and McCartney model. How do these two different geniuses working together lift one another up? Where do we see the influences? Where do we sense that the combination of the two made something greater than the sum of its parts? There are other models too. Two lovers, for example. What happens when passion gets into the mix? What happens when passion subsides? Or does it not subside but combust? What about jealousy, anger, disappointment, frustration, rage? We see siblings and mentors and proteges. We see friends writing letters to one another, helping each other out, commenting, editing, encouraging, disparaging. I love all of it. And today, we have this great example, a man and a woman, two people that life threw together, who met in kind of an inevitable way, looking back, but who also had a chance encounter that changed everything for them, united them. What did these two do for one another? How did inspiration work for them or against them? What happened when they collaborated, and how did it end so bitterly? Why did that happen? What were the consequences? And what does it mean? What can we take away from it? We'll take one more break, the last one, I promise, and then we'll get to our special guest, Yuval Taylor, author of the book, Zora and Langston, A Story of Friendship and Betrayal. Okay, joining me now is Yuval Taylor, senior editor at Chicago Review Press. Yuval is the co-author of Darkest America, Black Minstrelsy from Slavery to Hip Hop, and Faking It, The Quest for Authenticity in Popular Music. He's edited three volumes of African American slave narratives and has written for the Antioch Review, The Guardian, and other publications. He's here to discuss his latest work, Zora and Langston, A Story of Friendship and Betrayal. Yuval Taylor, welcome to the History of Literature podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I love unpacking pieces of literary history like this one, where two luminaries cross paths. In this case, we have two of the greatest 20th century American writers, two icons, really, Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. And they had this brief but powerful friendship at the height of their creative powers. And they also had a falling out that has been the source of endless fascination and speculation. So what drew you to this project?
Well, pretty much what you just said.
Yeah.
I got the idea of it for it when after I when I'd written Darkest America, which had a chapter on Zora Neale Hurston, I was asked, and I don't remember by whom, I was asked if there were any particular stories that I might be interested in expanding on for a magazine article, and immediately the story of Zora's friendship with Langston Hughes occurred to me. Then I thought, well, this shouldn't just be a magazine article. This could be a book.
Yeah.
It's just so much there.
And it's been, there have been biographies of them as individuals, but it sounds like the biographies really are only able to treat the friendship in kind of a, you know, they're only able to give it so many pages, so to speak.
Right.
So What were you able to draw upon in order to put together the full story of their friendship?
Well, a lot of their correspondence has been published. But what I was able to find, the material that to me was particularly instructive, that really hadn't been looked at before, was the material from Louise Thompson. Mm. Louise Thompson was the other woman in this ménage à trois.
Yeah.
And she wrote a memoir which has never been published, and it's in it's at Emory University. And also, she gave an interview with Tesoro's first biographer, Robert Hemingway, and she did not want him to transcribe it, so he just took handwritten notes. But in those handwritten notes are just priceless pieces of information.
Mm.
Those sources were extremely helpful to me. In addition, there was this correspondence between Langston Hughes and Charlotte Mason, which had not been published. Now some of it has, but when I was first doing my research, it wasn't there. And Charlotte Mason was both Zora's and Langston's patron, this 72-year-old white woman who gave them a lot of money and tried to control their careers. The correspondence that Langston had with Mason was really intense. And Zora then had a very close relationship with Mason, and Mason wrote in her diaries Zora's account of the whole contretemps that led to the breakup. And so we have, I guess, secondhand Zora's own account of the breakup through Mason's diaries, which is really fascinating.
Yeah.
And then there was, they had this cross-country road trip. They took this cross-country road trip together, and Langston documented it all in his journals. And he had two sets of journals. One was describing things he saw and things he heard and things people said. And the other one was financial. It just jotted down dates and money spent on what. And I was able to draw on both those journals to fill in all these details that no one else had.
Right.
So there were a few other sources that I took advantage of. A few other Harlem Renaissance writers gave interviews to Robert Hemingway besides Louise Thompson. And those are very helpful, particularly Bruce Nugent, who was another Harlem Renaissance figure who idolized Langston and was very close to Zora, and gave a lot of details in these interviews he did with Robert Hemingway. So there was a wealth of material to draw on that was not previously published, and I felt like that gave me something to contribute to the history that hadn't been in previous books.
Right. Okay. So I'm tempted to just ask you what the discoveries were, but I think we'd probably be jumping all around, and I think we should probably start at the beginning. But I also don't want to lose sight of the kind of excitement of finding out new things and things that this book is bringing to the table. So if you can, as we're going through the course of this friendship, maybe you could point out things, if it struck you at the time as being a particularly new or interesting detail that your book was able to bring to our understanding of this friendship.
Certainly.
Okay, so when and how did these two meet?
They met in May 1925 at the Opportunity Dinner, and this was the largest gathering of black and white intelligentsia in history at that point. It was an awards dinner organized by Opportunity magazine that featured the creme de la creme of white critics and fiction writers and poets, along with the creme de la creme of African American fiction writers, poets, and critics. And they all got together at this restaurant, the Fifth Avenue restaurant in New York City. And Zora and Langston walked away with the most awards of anyone there. And so that's where they met each other. And Langston was very intrigued by Zora. She was a very vivacious, charismatic figure, and said he commented after the dinner to Van Vechten that he would like to know her better. And he certainly got his wish.
And she was older. You say that he was 24 and she was 34, but passing for 24. Was she really passing for 24?
She was.
Yeah.
She was. Nobody really knew that she was so much older than she was.
Right.
She had been passing for years, because when she was in her mid to late 20s, she needed to go to high school to get her GED in Washington, D.C., and the high school was free if you were under 18.
Mm.
So she pretended to be under 18, and she'd been so she was passing even at that point.
Right.
She never acknowledged her true age, except when she was writing fiction. There's one story which is about a woman who's passing for who lives in Harlem and is passing for someone 10 years her. You know, she's taking off 10 years off her age, and it's she's clearly modeled after Zora, and that's the only time when Zora ever admitted to shaving years off her age.
Mm-hmm. And maybe as important as their youth, they were not established. You say they won the most prizes, but they did not come into that evening as sort of the king and queen of the Harlem Renaissance or anything like that. They were still pretty up and coming, right?
Well, Zora was completely unknown.
Yeah.
But Langston had been pretty widely published at that point, though he hadn't had a book come out. But people knew him as one of the younger poets who were really making a name for himself.
And how would you characterize them at that point in terms of their connection to the Harlem Renaissance? Were they deeply integrated into it, or were they on the periphery, or where did they stand there?
They were real newcomers, mm-hmm. because they didn't live in Harlem. Yeah, actually, at this point in May 1925, Langston was still living in Washington, D.C., and Zora had just moved to Harlem 2 or 3 months before.
Yeah.
And Langston had been to Harlem before, and he had met a number of the literati in 1924. He had lived in New York earlier than that. He knew Alan Locke, who was this professor who put together the standard anthology of the Harlem Renaissance, The New Negro, which came out a little bit later than this dinner, but it had already been started. So he had connections to the Harlem Renaissance. He knew Count Cullen, who was the other great poet of the era, and he had met Charles Johnson, who had organized the dinner. So he had connections.
Hmm.
But Zora was a real newcomer. She also knew Alan Locke because he was her professor when she went to Howard University.
Right.
She wasn't well known in those circles at all.
And when you say Langston identified her as someone he would like to get to know better, would you say that this was purely a personality decision? He thought she would be fun to know, or that she would be an interesting person to know? Was there any strategy involved, or kind of this looks like a future literary star or anything like that? What was drawing him to her at that award ceremony?
I would guess that it was the former, that she just had this personality, this insouciance that struck Langston as being, she was very charismatic. I mean, she did strike almost everyone who met her as a fascinating person, as someone who would be really fun to know. She was very attractive to, you know, to almost anyone who was interested in colorful characters.
She comes across in your description and other descriptions I've read as just somebody who walks into a room, lights up the room, and everyone's head turns to her, and she can kind of just entertain with the force of her personality.
Exactly, exactly.
I think that comes across in pictures. I mean, I have, mm-hmm. I collect these pictures of writers laughing, and the one of Zora was one of the most popular ones that I ever posted. It's like, she's so exuberant, and just her eyes are lit up, and they just seem like, she just seems like she was so full of life.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And I also wonder a little bit, I mean, the other thing that I was drawing from your book was how, she really could have had a career as an anthropologist.
Yes.
And she was on her way, and she was studying at Columbia in this sort of this great period for anthropology with Franz Boas. And it really was almost like her fiction and her creativity was just boiling over. It was almost uncontained, that it would never have really allowed her to pursue an academic career because she had too great of a creative spirit to be contained in something like academia. It had to come out in fiction and stories and storytelling.
That's very possible. I wonder whether she could have made it as an anthropologist. I mean, she wrote a number of books that are truly anthropological in nature, and that was always a huge part of her interests. But she was somewhat undisciplined, and it would have been hard for her to get a PhD because she wanted to go her own way, and she didn't want to be constrained by too academic a view of things and by certain academic approaches. But I think what really threw her off track or put her on off the academic track was her relationship with Charlotte Mason. Mm. When Charlotte Mason wanted to use Zora as a conduit to what Mason thought of as a pure African strain in American culture, and thought that Zora could bring about this immense change in American culture just through the force of her kind of primitive knowledge of the true African sources. It was a kind of mystical belief for Mason, and Mason, in her contract with Zora, enjoined Zora from communicating with Boas or Herskovitz or other anthropologists of the time. And her contract specified that she, Mason, would own all of Zora's work. Basically, Zora was out collecting folklore for Mason, and Mason would own it, and that was the be-all and end-all.
Right.
It didn't give Zora authority. It didn't give her authorial rights. She was just a folklore collector, and obviously that would chafe on anyone.
Yeah.
So Mason was very generous and gave Zora a lot of support, a lot of money, and enabled her to do these amazing researches in Alabama, in Florida, in the Bahamas. But it was very difficult for Zora to communicate all of the material she found to other anthropologists or to be part of the academic conversation because of Mason's tight control over her work.
Right. And while we're on the subject of Mason, I think this is important to understand in relationship with the Harlem Renaissance, and especially the jealousies or the rivalries that developed. The stakes here were really high. And I think it's more than just, well, there's only, you know, so many awards to go around and we're all competing for the same ones, or there's only so much room in the publishing world for all of us, and it's a sort of a zero-sum game for the Harlem Renaissance writers. It had this element of these white patrons who were also had an agenda. And so what they have in mind is, you know, what artists I would imagine would want more than anything else if they're being funded is to have the artistic freedom and to be able to, you know, make statements and compose their poetry or write their novels with no constraints or with no strings attached to that. And instead, kind of what we were seeing is with an example of Charlotte Mason, you know, she had her own views of what was going to come out of the Harlem Renaissance, and she was supporting the arts, but she was also kind of trying to foster, as you said, an awakening in American culture that would come about through the promotion of these African-American writers. And so you could see where other people, other artists and other participants in the Harlem Renaissance would look at that and say, well, this isn't the agenda that I want, or this isn't the way I view our role in this society. And the art here could have a different purpose altogether. And the sort of the arguments and the rivalries become more of on a social scale rather than just the purely literary or the purely artistic.
Yes, that's very well put. You know, when you're talking about white involvement in the Harlem Renaissance, it's very, very complicated, because besides the patronage of Charlotte Mason, you have a lot of publishers who are promoting the work of Harlem Renaissance writers, and you have art collectors like Albert Barnes, who is promoting the artwork and African art and the artwork of African Americans. And he's something of a patron too. You know, you have different patrons with different motives. Mm. You have a lot of white playwrights were writing works for black casts, and they had very different ideas of what they were trying to accomplish. And you have Green Pastures, which won the Pulitzer in 1930, was the biggest hit on Broadway, with an all-black cast and a white author. which is very different from, say, Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones, which was Paul Robeson's starring vehicle years earlier. So all of this activity by white patrons generates a huge amount of artistic activity and just a flourishing of talent, but it never comes with no strings attached.
Right. Okay. So against that backdrop, we have Zora and Langston, who encounter one another at this awards ceremony, where they're both two of the leading lights of the evening. And then what happened? How did their friendship blossom after that?
Well, they together with a few other Harlem writers formed a group that Zora called the Niggerati, and they call themselves that as well. As offensive as it sounds, they loved that term, and they were proud of being part of it. Hmm. And they started a magazine called Fire, which only lasted one issue. But these were the youngest of the Harlem Renaissance writers, and they were determined to be as scandalous and nonconformist as possible. The African-American intelligentsia hated their work, and they were trying to scandalize them. They were making – Fire was basically – one of their goals was to get it banned in Boston, as I said. It was just full of sex. Two of the writers, Wallace Thurman and Bruce Nugent, decided that they would toss coins to see who was going to write about a prostitute and who was going to write about a homosexual affair. So Thurman wrote, the magazine Fire opens with Thurman's story, Cordelia the Crude, which is about a teenage prostitute. And then the longest piece in it is Bruce Nugent's Lilies and Jade, which is a homosexual, what he calls a novel. It's kind of more like a prose poem.
And did they get banned in Boston?
I don't know, but they certainly were reviled by everyone.
Right.
But they made a splash, and that's what they were really trying to do. So these were the some of these writers were still in their teens, and all the rest were in their 20s. Only Zora was in her 30s, but she wouldn't admit to that. And one other artist, Augusta Savage, was also in her 30s.
And were Zora and Langston, were they meeting each other? Was this all happening face to face?
They were all together in this house in Harlem that was called Niggerati Manor. I mean, it's curious to hear the descriptions of it. In Wallace Thurman's Romana Clef, the walls were Bruce Nugent had painted the walls with brightly colored phalluses. So it's just this really wild place. And that's where Langston lived, and that's where they gathered, and that's where they made their plans.
Right.
They had, I think, a 6 or 7 person editorial staff, and Zora and Langston were both on that staff.
Right. And this was sort of in 1925 still, or
1926.
1926.
They also had talked about Zora and Langston had talked about collaborating on an opera. So they were pretty close, but they didn't really cement their friendship until 1927 when they went on a road trip together.
Mm. And where did they go?
It's one of the most fortuitous coincidences in American literary history that Zora and Langston happened to meet on the streets of Mobile, Alabama one day in June 1927. Langston was on a break from a train from New Orleans to Tuskegee, Alabama, and he went out on the street and there was Zora, who was in town to interview Cudjoe Lewis, who was the oldest slave who had been born in Africa and was still alive.
Wow.
They just happened to meet, and Langston told Zora where he was headed, and Zora said, "Oh, come ride with me in my car. I'll take you there, and then we can go back to New York together." And so they took this road trip together. They traveled the back roads of the South. They went to Macon. They went into the country to see Conjurman. They went to Savannah. They went to Cheraw. They went all over the place in the South and had all these adventures and became really, really close friends during that journey.
And how would you say that they viewed one another? Was this Were they brother and sister? Were they artistic allies, two geniuses who enjoyed what they were able to bring out in one another? Or how would you characterize their friendship?
I think what you just said, two geniuses who enjoyed what they were able to bring out in one another. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so how much time did they spend together? And this, it sounds like this may have continued for at least a couple of years, this closeness.
They were in the South together 5 or 6 weeks, if I remember right. Though there was 1 week during that time when they were apart, when they both went to Tuskegee, and then Langston went on a movable school on a trip to teach poor African Americans in northern Alabama. Well, Zora stayed behind in Tuskegee, but besides that, they were together those 5 or 6 weeks, and Langston had just met Charlotte Mason at that point before his trip down south, and he told Zora about her and promised to introduce her to her. Mm. And so when they came back to New York, that happened. They both were under contract with Charlotte Mason. Langston was being paid $150 a month, and Zora was being paid $200 a month. And so they had something else in common then. And that is, you know, trying to figure out how to deal with this new patronage.
Right.
Zora at this point didn't live in Harlem anymore. She had moved out of Harlem in 1925 and had an apartment on 66th Street. From this point on, Charlotte Mason was funding her to do research, and that research had to be done in the South and in the Bahamas and elsewhere. So their friendship was conducted mostly through the mail, and they wrote dozens of letters to each other, and Zora shared all her work with Langston. Langston shared his work with Zora. They commented on each other's work. They were very fond of each other. It's very clear from their correspondence. Yeah. Zora, I think, was especially fond of Langston. She asked him to send her his pictures so she could gaze upon his face, and she signed her letters lovingly, "Yours," and that kind of thing.
Was there any suggestion of romance between the two, or... were there rumors of that?
There were not rumors of that. And the suggestions of romance I have are pretty thin. Mm. Langston was not the kind of guy to have any kind of sexual relations with anyone he knew well. Mm. He just didn't do that throughout his life. He didn't do that. It seems like he only had sex with strangers. Mm. And he really avoided very heavy emotional entanglements.
Right.
You know, there's this reticence on his part that you see, not just with Zora, but with all of his relationships. But at the same time, Zora, I don't think that she had romantic designs on Langston. It's a little bit hard to tell, but her relationships also were characterized by brevity. I mean, she was married 3 times and none of the marriages lasted more than 6 weeks or something like that. Hmm. So again, she also was like the long-term commitment type.
Right. Okay. So as they were reviewing each other's work, and I'm sure they were obviously, impressed by one another, can we detect any influence on one another? Were they fully formed, or do you think that either of them was influential in some way on the other?
I don't think Langston influenced Zora. Mm. Zora loved his book of poetry, Fine Clothes to the Jew, and she read it out loud to people she met, whom she was gathering folklore from. You know, so she would go to a lumber camp and she would read out loud from Langston's book, and they would love his blues-based poems and comment on them, and you know. But I don't see that being part of her own writing. She herself didn't write poetry, and Langston at that point hadn't written much fiction. I also don't think that Langston's work was very influenced by Zora's, you know, his poetry at least. I think it was sui generis. A lot of it was written before he met her, and so no, I don't know. Mm. The influence I see, the things that I see them influencing each other were their essays. Mm. I really think Langston's essay, "The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain," was an extremely important essay of the time, and you can definitely see echoes of it in a couple essays that Zora later wrote. I think there is that influence.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to the theater, that's where the lines get a little blurred, because since they wrote a play together, it's hard to say what kind of influence they had on each other there.
Right. I did an episode on Sherwood Anderson not too long ago, and mm-hmm. he was constantly helping young writers who Hemingway and Faulkner, and they would look at him and look at his style and his example, and then they would have to overthrow him. You know, they would have to reject him in some way or disparage him. And that seems to be a really common for artists when they're close and friendly, and then they have to make this break. But it sounds like we can take that away as one of the possibilities here. How did their friendship end, and was it a clean break, or was it more of drifting apart?
It was neither really a clean break nor a drifting apart. It was a violent clash.
Oh, okay.
At first, they collaborated on this play, Mulebone. And at first, the first thing that happened to break them up was that Charlotte Mason got very angry that they were working on a play together. And she believed that Langston had taken Zora off track and was distracting from her work as a folklorist, was very angry at Langston for doing this, and was basically giving up on Langston, because Langston had by this time finished his novel and wasn't really writing any poetry, whereas Zora was working really hard on her folklore with Langston's help, and that was what Mason had been placing all our hopes on.
Right. Was Langston at this point, did he have some measure of financial independence, or was he still dependent on?
No, he was still totally dependent on Mason.
Oof, right.
So Mason and Langston severed ties, and Mason told both of them not to work on the play anymore. And Zora basically took the play and went off on her own and had no more contact with Langston. And there is some evidence that at this point she was beginning to feel jealousy.
Mm.
And she was jealous of Louise Thompson. Louise Thompson was their typist. She was extremely close to Langston, to Zora, and to Mason. She actually shared a bed with Zora. Zora actually propositioned her at one point. She was totally in love with Langston and wanted to marry him. And Mason was paying her. You can't imagine a more complicated relationship than that.
Yeah.
And at some point, Zora begins to get very jealous of Thompson.
Right.
So there's this drifting apart that happens in 1930, where Zora basically goes off. And instead of finishing her folklore manuscript, she works on the play and works on the play and works on the play. And she tries to expunge all of Langston's contributions to it. Meanwhile, Langston goes and shows the play in his version of it to Jasper Dieter, who is a head of a small theater company in Pennsylvania, without getting Zora's permission. And when he tells her about this, Zora probably felt that Langston was trying to steal her work. The breakup with Mason completely devastates Langston. His relationship with Mason was the strongest emotional bond of his whole life. And when they break up, he gets physically sick and can't eat and can't work and goes to see doctors to try to figure out what's wrong with him, but it's very clear what's wrong with him. It's just a completely devastating breakup. So he ends up going to Cleveland, and his mother's living there, and he's not well. And then he finds out from close friends of his who run a theater troupe in Cleveland that Zora has a play available to be produced by this theater troupe. And this is the play that he and Zora had collaborated on. And his name was not on the title page. So, and this play had been sent without either of their knowledge to the Jelliffes in Cleveland by someone who had gotten a copy from another friend of theirs in New York. So it was not Zora who was trying to push the play. Zora didn't want it to be produced in Cleveland. She still had her eyes on Broadway. So this became another point of contention, and there were a lot of letters sent back and forth and a lot of heartrending apologies and bitter words, and you know, every day something would change, and Langston would threaten a lawsuit and then would apologize, and you know, one thing after another.
Do you think they were this attached to the play because they believed in it so strongly, or was this kind of a proxy for this whole dynamic of these various falling outs and attempts to exert control and wrest control away from one another with these four individuals?
I think they really believed in the play.
Yeah.
Langston had always loved theater, and it was his big passion when he was young. His mother was an actress. He had never really written anything for the theater, but it's telling that right after he wrote Mulebone, he wrote Mulatto. So it was clearly inspired him to work in that genre. Mm-hmm. And Zora had written a number of plays before, but she also loved the theater, and she saw this as her ticket to success.
Right.
Mulebone was going to be a Broadway hit.
Yeah.
And so they were very attached to the play.
And that could have been very lucrative for them. And
absolutely.
Would that have cut out the patron? And was that part
yes.
of the dynamic here? Okay. So the patron
absolutely.
Is maybe that's one of the reasons why she's pulling on the two of them to try to interrupt with this play, which could give them the liberation from her and her money, that she would have no longer played the central role in their lives.
Yeah. Mason really didn't have a very high opinion of the theater in general. So she really wanted Zora to complete her folklore work. And basically, at this point, she had been supporting Harlem Renaissance artists for 3 years and felt like she had not gotten much out of it. And Zora's folklore work was the basket that she was placing all her eggs in.
Mm. So did Zora and Langston express regrets about the way this had all gone down? Did they live to a point where they were able to reconcile or kind of put the play in perspective, or did it remain bitter for the rest of their lives?
Well, certainly for Langston, it remained bitter for the rest of his life. Mm. Langston attempted to reconcile. He offered to give up all his rights in the play, but in doing so, he was asking Zora for a favor as well.
Mm.
And Zora really thought that was very dishonorable of him because it was her play to begin with. So he did try to reconcile a little bit, but it was half-hearted and never carried through. Zora, on the other hand, told Arna Bontemps, who was Langston's best friend, that the cross of her life was her breakup with Langston.
Mm.
It was very emotional about it and was very upset about it, but felt that Langston had treated her very badly. And she also really emphasized the jealousy aspect of the breakup, you know, basically saying that it wasn't so much about authorial rights as it was about Langston's carrying on with Louise Thompson. And I think that was not true. I mean, that was a big part of it, but the authorial rights was another big part of it.
Right.
But she was exaggerating that to Arna Bontemps so that Langston would feel that he could reconcile with her. And so Arna Bontemps really tried to get them back together again. This was in 1937 and failed. Mm. Langston did not reply to his letter or his urging. So I don't know, it was a rocky relationship even after that, because when Langston wrote his autobiography in 1940, Zora was really looking forward to reading it, wanted to review it, actually went to a reading that Langston gave. And then when she read it, it was so condescending and so insulting. Langston called her a perfect darkie that she basically turned and wrote her own autobiography and left him out of it altogether.
Mm.
You know, just gone.
Do you think, looking back, do you think that it was inevitable? Was the real surprise here that there was a period where they were as close as they were? Was there something about their outlook on life or their artistic positions or political positions? Is there something that made them odd bedfellows, so to speak, from the beginning? Or does it seem like a shame and a wasted opportunity and a series of miscommunications and, you know, that it didn't need to have happened this way?
It was inevitable from one point of view, and that is Langston had dramatic breakups.
Mm.
really, really dramatic breakups with Alan Locke, with Kante Cullen, with Mason, with Zora Neale Hurston, with a few other figures. And it's really, he was a very cagey guy who people basically fell in love with, and he would not return that affection and tried to run away from that. In that sense, you can see a pattern there that Zora just kind of fits right into.
But it seems like if anyone was going to break the pattern, it could be her with her personality.
I think that, you know, there were other people that broke the pattern. Louise Thompson remained friends with Langston all his life. Oliver Herb, Arne Bontemps did too.
Yeah.
He didn't break up with everyone.
Right.
And there's something also inevitable about Zora too, in that male black writers, every single one of them turned on her and attacked her work. Langston didn't actually attack Zora's work, but Alan Locke did, and certainly Richard Wright did, Ralph Ellison, Sterling Brown, just every black writer that you can think of who commented on Zora's work, a black male writer, had something negative to say about it.
All for the same reasons?
Pretty much. They all felt that Zora underplayed African-American resentment and hid it, and that Zora was playing to the white folks in her work, and was emphasizing, you know, the kind of the joy, the laughter, and the tears of African-American culture rather than its bitter reality.
Right. I wish I had flagged the quote, but you had sort of Zora's response to that in your book.
Yeah, and Zora responded in a number of different ways to that.
She basically had said that this was something that she was choosing to prioritize because of the way it would, I thought it was kind of the way it would enable people to rise above the conflict.
Well, she had no room for bitterness in her work. And she felt like bitterness was a very counterproductive thing to express, that if you acknowledge that you are a victim, you become powerless.
Right.
And I think that's that you find that in a lot of the work of oppressed people. I think that she's right on target in many ways. Her quote went something like, to feel resentment is, oh, I can't remember, but something about drinking poison. drinking, it's like drinking poison and expecting the person who gave you the poison to die.
Right.
You know, she says, I have no resentment for white folks. The pink-toed rascals can be of some use to us, you know?
Right.
And she also says, I have no resentment because I'm too busy sharpening my oyster knife. To feel bitter is to feel defeated. And Zora never, ever wanted to feel defeated.
Right.
That's not in her vocabulary.
I wanted to just tie this back to Langston a little bit, and they're falling out. Well, first of all, the question I have, the subtitle of your book is A Story of Friendship and Betrayal. I was going to ask who betrayed whom, but it sounds like there were multiple betrayals to go around here.
Certainly were. That's right.
Okay. Maybe I'll leave that for the readers to untangle all of those. I did want to ask how you ended up feeling, if there's anything we can learn about the nature of creative friendships or friendship in general, and what it was like for you to spend time immersed in this friendship and this feud. Did you end up feeling inspired or saddened or?
Friendship is, it's a very complicated thing because it goes hand in hand with love, and it can be lasting and fulfilling, and it can be terribly disappointing and heartbreaking, just like love can. I think that Zora didn't have a good grasp of what friendship could be. She wrote this really weird chapter on friendship in her autobiography, and that chapter was actually cut, but it was published later, where she compares friendship to a hill that is being shone on by the sun and getting warmed by the sun, and then clouds come and get between them. And it's a very one-sided relationship. There's no give and take between a hill and the sun.
Yeah.
it's not an absolutely pessimistic view of friendship, but I think Zora felt extremely grateful for all the people who were her friends. And she viewed friendship as this wonderful gift that she was receiving, and didn't see her own part in friendships. She didn't see how valuable she was to the people who loved her. On the other hand, Langston really, I think, understood friendship because he had these lifelong friends. Arne Bontemps is a great example. But what he was really afraid of was emotional commitment. That was really hard for him. So what I get out of that, I don't know if there are any really lessons that I learned from it, because, you know, I'm now, I'm in my 50s. I've had a whole life full of friendships.
Right.
But I guess I felt like neither of them appreciated what this friendship could have. Well, maybe they did, but I don't know if either of them appreciated what this friendship could have become.
Right.
It's hard to say.
Right. Oh, okay. Let's end things there. The book is Zora and Langston, A Story of Friendship and Betrayal. It's a beautiful book, physically beautiful. And it's also beautiful on the inside. It's very enjoyable to read. It has photographs in the middle, which I think used to be more common than it is now. I don't know if that's your experience as well. It seems like the kids, the books I got when I was a kid always had photos in the middle, and I don't see it as much anymore. It also has a gorgeous dust jacket. It's worth buying in hardcover, reading, or giving as a gift. It's a wonderful book to have on your shelves. Yuval Taylor, thank you so much for joining me today on The History of Literature.
Thank you, Jackie. It was really fun to talk.
Okay, there we go. My thanks to Yuval Taylor. What a great subject, and what a great book. We're headed into the holidays, people. Put this one on your list. Makes a great gift for someone you love, maybe someone you're friends with, or someone you're planning to betray. I'm kidding. Don't betray anyone. Let your friends betray you. Kidding again. This makes a great gift for someone you love, even if that someone happens to be yourself. Maybe especially then. Check it out at bookstores near you. Maybe on the internet. Zora and Langston, A Story of Friendship and Betrayal. We'll be back soon. Has it been too long since we had Mike Palindrome on the show? Should we have him on again soon, people? We hear the cries from the angry throngs. Here in our castle tower, we are aware that there is unrest among the masses. Give us Mike. Give us Mike. They chant and we scurry around anxiously. What do they want? What do they want? They want Mike. They want Mike. Okay, okay. Hold them off. Maybe some cauldrons of boiling oil need to be tipped over while we get Mike. For God's sake, get Mike on the show. We can't keep the unwashed masses at bay forever. Don't worry, those of you at bay, you shall not be at bay forever. Put down your pitchforks, which is good advice for all of us. I'm holding two right now, as it happens. I've been carrying them around for weeks. For some reason, they've been a source of comfort to me. But now I see the error of my ways, and I'll lay them down here in the studio. I'm Jack Wilson, pitchfork free and feeling good. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.